You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. The following message has been brought to you by Fairway Market. What's the buzz about honey? Well, those busy little bees are up to something, and it is delicious. The Fairway label honey is superb. Fairway only hires worker bees that are the best at what they do. This makes for a great tasting, high quality honey at an amazing value with the Fairway stamp of approval. And on top of being delicious, honey is a great substitute for other sweeteners and can even benefit your health. This includes better energy, respiratory improvements, and balanced blood sugar levels. It's a no-brainer. Get your Fairway honey today.
Wow, I am exhausted after all those intros. It's very exciting how much is going on.
That's right.
I'm Patrick Martins.
I'm Katie Kiefer.
We're broadcasting out of Roberta's. This is The Main Course, one of 22 shows on the Heritage Radio Network. We are engineered and produced by Jack Inslee. We have a great show lined up. I mean, you basically have gotten us to get Temple Grandin second time now. So hard to hear her and see her out there, and so the fact that you get her to be on is such an honor.
Well, it's such a pleasure to have her, and she's so extremely informative and helpful about understanding and unraveling the whole livestock industry.
We also have a great chef who, you know, hundreds of people come through his restaurant a day, and his name is Damian Sansonetti. He has been on before, and he is the head chef of Bar Balloud in front of Lincoln Center on New York City's Upper West Side.
Absolutely awesome.
So we got a real powerhouse show. Our show is now 1 hour. It used to be, I think it was 3.5 hours every Sunday.
Oh, yeah.
And now we have condensed it down to 1 hour.
That's right, short and sweet.
So one thing I wanted to congratulate you and Jack about is these Daily Bites, which is a 45-second to 1 minute food kind of bite. And it covers things like Hurricane Irene for New York State farmers, or the nutritional benefits of coconut water, or, you know, it talks about the rise of vermouth and cocktail lounges around the country. And they're perfectly edited and consistent, so our effort is that they are going to be syndicated around the country, and we're going to be sending them to NPR stations, and really hope that kind of the voice of the network reaches more Americans through these little bites. So those bites are going to start airing every day starting on Monday.
And let me congratulate you on the opening of the Heritage flagship store, Heritage Meat Shop, in the Essex Street Market down on Delancey Street. That's a milestone in the Heritage history. Absolutely awesome. You're going to be selling what? Let's hear the product lineup.
Well, we have, you know, our fresh meats, which come, you know, from various different breeds of pig and cow and goat and things like that. Then we're going to have an unbelievable charcuterie section, you know, most of which is products made using the pigs that we, you know, help get these producers. So we have Armandino Batali is going to be selling his stuff there, Saluma Rio Rosi. We hope one day Daniel Balloud with his just, if I could pick one that I would beg for, is the Grand Mare. It's my favorite.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, the Daniel Balloud one. But we're going to have Al Benton's prosciutto, Sam Edwards's, Nancy Newsom. So it's going to be really great. And then we're going to make the best sandwiches using Roberta's bread, ham and butter, the Italian. So it's going to be very, very exciting. And we're going to be selling goat there because, as you know, we're about to be in the throes of our No Goat Left Behind project.
That's right. Starting in October, right?
And you can go to Bar Balloud and actually try goat different ways because they have committed to this project.
So. Well, on the website, there's a whole list of the restaurants that will be participating in No Goat Left Behind.
500 goats, 1 month, helping, you know, say, and this is the big thing about No Goat Left Behind, and then we'll bring on Temple. We kill most of our male dairy goats are killed or sold into a horrible commodity market environment. Meanwhile, the U.S. is importing 17 million pounds
statistic.
Of goat so far this year. So we're killing males, killing, you know, God's creatures, not letting them live but 2 minutes on this earth while importing goats from New Zealand. I mean, it makes no sense. We should be raising these goats to maturity and consuming them, you know, and honoring them. So it's a really, really great project. And Erin Fairbanks has been unbelievable. She's really pulled it all together.
She really has. So let's, should we take like a just a 1 second break and come right back with Dr. Temple Grandin? We're back on the main course on Heritage Radio Network. It's my great pleasure and my privilege to address and introduce Dr. Temple Grandin, a professor of animal sciences at Colorado State University and a consultant and designer of livestock handling facilities the world over. She is the proprietress of Grandin Livestock Handling Systems, Inc. You can check out her website anytime. Temple, thank you so much for waiting on the phone for us. It's a great pleasure to have you. How are you?
Well, it's good to be here.
Hi, great. Temple.
Temple, let's jump right in. I know when you and I spoke on the phone, you were saying that you had some new information about animal handling protocols. What you've been working on?
Been working a lot on improving auditing procedures. Mm-hmm. Some of the plants now have put in video auditing where auditors in another state can look in at any time and see the cattle handling, see the cattle stunning, make sure all the animals are rendered insensible. And that prevents the problem of people acting good when the back's turned. And the Cargill Corporation and has already put that in all their beef plants in North America.
That's amazing. And what about some of the other big companies that you work with? I know you've done some work for Smithfield, for instance. Are they following suit and doing the third-party auditing stream?
Well, basically, you know, they got JBS Swift and Cargill are doing it. And then there's about five or six different independents that are doing it. And hopefully, you know, the rest of the industry is going to follow, you know. But Cargill was the pioneer.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So what is the result if someone fails one of these video audits? Can you take us through the process of...
Well, let's just to go through the whole process and it started. In 1999, I was hired by McDonald's Corporation to implement their animal welfare auditing program. And I developed a very simple scoring system for evaluating slaughter plants. How many animals did you render instantly insensible with one shot? Then everything has to be dead before you hang it up on the rail. How many cattle are mooing and bellowing during handling? In order to pass the audit, you're only allowed 3 cattle out of 100 mooing and bellowing right in the stunning chute area. How many animals fall during handling? How many animals got an electric prodder put on them? These are things that I can measure with hard numbers. And the advantage of this is it avoids the problem of a lot of vague guidelines. And this is something now with all the interest in local food, you don't want vague guidelines like, you know, handle them properly or an acceptable amount of space, because what does that mean? And this real simple scoring system got implemented, and it really worked because the plants knew exactly what was expected. And when we first started, people did all kinds of bad stuff in front of you because they just didn't know any better. And then, you know, 5 years into the program or so, you know, there were some places that knew how to act good when the auditor was around. And so I'm really excited about the video auditing because that prevents the problem of acting good. And it's also being used in food safety to make sure that in really critical parts of skinning the animal, that the knife is sterilized each time. And when the back's turned, oftentimes things aren't all that good. And what Cargill has done is they've started contests between their plants on who can get the best scores, and the ones that get the best scores, the employees might get a pizza party. So they want to try to keep things really positive.
That sounds like a really good structure for the auditing and encouraging employees to follow, because what happens to them if they don't? Then the plant gets shut down until the problem is corrected,
you know,
right?
And the unfortunate thing that's been found out in 10 years of working on improving slaughter plants is there some people that absolutely shouldn't be working with animals.
Yes.
They like to hurt them. And what we've got, the situation we've got with our little plants now, is they tend to be very variable because they're so dependent upon the personality of that owner. And if he cares about doing things right, they're good. And if he doesn't care about doing things right, they can be really bad.
Right, absolutely.
I've noticed that too, especially in very small plants also. Sometimes they bring in too many animals, and then the animals end up spending 3-4 days there waiting for their moment in the processing line. And that's very cruel, you know, because they don't always have water.
Well, if they're spending 3 or 4 days there, they better have plenty of feed and water.
Yeah.
And someplace to lie down.
The Humane Water Act requires that they have water.
Yeah. And also they have to have space to lie down, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
No, that's absolutely right.
You know, speaking of Cargill, I'm going to actually jump to something that, since they are the people who had the huge turkey recall, and I know that poultry is not so much your field, but I did want to head down the road of explaining to people the difference between all these different chemicals that get pushed into animals in the commodity market. So if you could explain for the audience,
well,
what
the
are
problem the... is with all of these you know, all those food safety pathogens and stuff coming out, like this latest thing they had over in Germany, and,
right.
and was that actually came out of a person and had nothing to do with livestock. I mean, there are all kinds of pathogens that are just evolving. You know, we've got the jet airplane that spreads everything around, and it's getting more and more difficult to prevent some of these pathogens.
Absolutely. But in the case of, for instance, the turkey recall, it was Salmonella Heidelberg was the pathogen, and that's a pathogen that has become resistant to all of the cephalexin antibiotic drugs that we typically use in humans. And so I wondered if you would, because I know when we talked about on the phone, you mentioned something called beta agonists as well as growth promotants, and I think that there's a lot of confusion amongst the public about those.
And first of all, they don't give any hormones to poultry.
Uh-huh.
Okay, let's just discuss what's actually done. Okay, in cattle, growth promoting hormones, you know, used as a pellet, that's a slow release pellet stuck under the skin of the ear. That's been used for decades.
Right.
And as far as I read a lot of scientific literature, and I can't find anything that shows that that's dangerous.
Okay.
The only thing you might think silly about it is, why do we cut off the hormones that the bull comes with that are free and then spend money putting them back into his ear? Then you have antibiotics put in feed. And then the third thing that's much more recent is beta agonists.
Yeah, what
are
those?
Not a hormone, and they are not an antibiotic. They're a drug that enhances growth, and that's being used in pigs and in cattle. And if you overdo it, you can get problems with lameness and heat stress. Now, turkeys are not getting beta agonists, and they get antibiotics, but they do not get hormones or beta agonists.
Interesting.
Now, is there anything wrong with this? I mean, I think of the tenets of slow food, and it just that, you know, they would say, wait, you can't do this type of thing
well,
to animals?
Well, one of the things I think is a big problem is pushing animals too hard, and you can do it too hard with genetics. I mean, we push the dairy cow to milk more and more and more to where the dairy cow lasts only 2 years.
Right.
Pigs got into a horrible problem with lameness. And the other thing is quality of meat and quantity of meat are kind of two opposing goals. And it doesn't matter whether you do it genetically, where there's no hormones or anything involved in it, or you do it with drugs and hormones and things like that. And like it with poultry, you know, push the genetics so hard in some of these big turkeys that they'll snap a tendon and have all kinds of problems with the legs. And that's purely genetic. That has nothing to do with any kind of drugs or hormones.
Right. But do livestock producers have to tell how much of these drugs that they are using, or is that like a proprietary information that each individual
producer... Well,
actually,
producer... you can test for these different things, but it gets down to one of my big concerns is pushing too hard, and of all, in looking at the things, the hormones in the ear, I haven't been able to find one drop of evidence to show that that's dangerous. As long as the hormone is put underneath the skin of the ear, now antibiotics... I subscribe to science and nature, and I've been reading tons of red flags. I'm going to just call them tons and tons of red flags, and I get very sensitive about the subject of resistance because I've had resistant urinary tract infections that were scary and mm-hmm. dangerous. Beta agonists, my main concern is welfare of the animal. As far as I know, there's no safety problem. But I'm concerned about pushing the animal's biology to the point where they're lame and they're getting heat stressed.
Right.
If you overdo it. And my approach to things is use an outcome-based thing, and if they show up at the plant lame, then there needs to be some trouble for that. Or they show up at the plant and their mouths are open because they've got heat stress.
Right.
You know, those are things that are definite, you know, definite welfare issues. But you can also create in the turkeys and poultry most of those problems with pushing biology have been done with genetics, just with breeding.
Right.
No biotech, just plain old breeding, put roosters and hens together.
Right. What did you think of the GAO report on that came out just a couple of days ago? That's the Government Accounting Office saying that there was no clear evidence between the use of subtherapeutic antibiotics and pathogen, you know, resistant strains to antibiotics.
I'd be perfectly honest, I have not read it yet.
Okay.
So I can't comment on it.
Yeah, because that's been all over the trade papers.
And I've been, I had flu last week, and
oh, no.
I didn't do very much reading. I had a lot of trips out of town that I had to drag myself through.
I'm sorry.
Now, let me ask,
I didn't know you were going to ask me about that, or I would have tried to have gotten it off the internet.
Well, I just read it the other day. It's okay. That's another conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll have you back if ever you would honor us.
I'd have to read that. I can't comment on a report I haven't read.
Understood, Temple. No worries.
So let me ask, is it part of your mandate, you know, karmically to the animals, but also to the people who, you know, pay for you, your job and all that, to come out against companies that consistently break the law? I mean, how does that work?
Well, there's kind of two ways to make change in the world. And you have people that, you know, let's kind of look at, you know, making things out of steel, because I have to have a visual analogy. Activists soften steel by heating it. And then people like me that are implementers can then bend and shape the steel into pretty grill work.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like, I work on how do you actually implement things? How do you actually make things work? One of the big problems we've got in so many things today, everything's getting too abstract. I think one of the reasons why people want to get back with local food is there's a real hunger to get back in touch with real things. And that's why people are getting interested in things like backyard chickens and gardening and growing their own food. And one of the problems we've got, I don't know, I see in government a lot of things today, it's all abstract, fighting over ideology. And
yeah.
There's no practical. How are we actually going to solve problems?
Right. How are you going to solve the problem of making enough food without actually being cruel to animals? I think that's the key problem, right? So you mentioned other mutating bugs that you've seen in scientific literature that you've read recently.
Well, listeria. I just was, we had a listeria outbreak here in Colorado.
Yeah, with the cantaloupes. I was reading about that.
And salmon had showed up with some listeria. It seems to just be increasing problems. You know, because when I first went in the industry in the 70s, we were really grungy. I'd wear a white coat out in the cattle yard and then go in the meat part. Well, today, that's not allowed. You're not allowed to do that. You got to wash your hands, and you got to walk through boot sterilizer and all the grubby stuff we did in the 70s. You're not allowed to do that today. You go in those big plants today, they got steam cabinets to, you know, clean the meat off. They're very particular about how they skin the legs so you don't get dirt from the hide onto the meat. And even with all these interventions, we're having more and more problems because the germs are out there mutating. I mean, the original 0157 was a mutation, you know, that didn't,
right.
They didn't exist before.
What about the five new ones that they've added to the list of adulterants recently?
This is the problem. I mean, we got more and more of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And all I can say about the antibiotic thing, I've seen a ton of red flags. And that's the one thing where there's a lot of red flags I've been reading in Science and Nature. And the other thing that concerns me, and I'm a visual thinker.
Right.
I don't think in the abstract. I am not concerned about eating the meat from an animal-fed antibiotics. That meat is safe. Where I'm concerned, and where I think the problem might be coming from, is the animals are excreting large amounts of antibiotics, the metabolites of those antibiotics, and where do you think that goes? It goes back on the land.
Right.
Well, nobody's studying that.
Really? Nobody is studying that? That's why the GAO says they can't make the connection? Because
well,
nobody
been a
is making that?
Well, there's little studies where there's been some transfer of resistance.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens to tons of the stuff that goes out onto the land?
Right.
I mean, we've got problems right now. The Denver wastewater treatment plant with hermaphroditic fish at the exit point of the wastewater treatment plant, and that's from all the hormones. And a lot of those hormones that are in the wastewater are just naturally coming out of people when they use the bathroom.
Yeah. Right. Scary. Well, you're told not to.
Oh, another thing is plastic water bottles. You know, you get something you want to get worried about. First trimester, boy, I don't think you ought to be drinking out of those clear plastic water bottles because those plasticizers act as endocrine disruptors.
Wow.
you know, that's something I am concerned about. I tend to not be an alarmist about these sort of things, mm-hmm. but I don't think a baby should be drinking out of those hard plastic bottles, and he needs to be drinking out of glass or polyethylene. That's the one plastic that doesn't leach.
Very nice. Well,
now, I'm 64 years old, so I drink out of them even after they've been in the car for 2 weeks. They taste like plastic because I don't have to worry about it. I'm too old to worry about it.
But wait a second.
But you have to live forever, Temple.
You didn't look 64 in that movie.
Well, the movie showed me in the 60s and the 70s.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because we're here with the very successful chef who's going to be the guest after you today in studio, and he actually assigns that movie to all of his chefs. Like, if a chef's going to come work with them, they have to watch that movie first. So how do you think that movie, you know, adequately portrayed and educated Americans on the issues that are important to you?
Well, it really showed autism accurately. It showed my visual thinking accurately. It showed my, you know, cattle designs accurately. And people always ask me, do the cows know they're going to get slaughtered? I found they were more afraid of a shadow, you know, a chain hanging down, seeing a car going by, things that we tend to not notice. And they behave the same way at the slaughterhouse as they behave going in the veterinary chute. I mean, there's going to be some stress there, but they're not going up that chute going, we know we're going to die. Because at the original Swift plant, in the movie they called it Abbott, but it actually was Swift plant in Arizona in the 70s, and that plant only had a 5-foot, 6-inch fence, which the cattle were very capable of jumping out of, but yikes. They did not.
Huh.
Now, do you still speak to Claire Danes? I mean, did you guys develop a friendship as she studied
Claire,
with you?
You know, it's like a lot of things, like building projects. You know, you go on to the next job, she's on the next job, I'm working on the next uh-huh. job. But Claire did an absolutely fantastic job. She became me. I spent quite a lot of time with her. She videoed, recorded that time. I gave her another 5 or 6 hours of ancient old tapes so that she could, you know, become me. She just did an amazing job, and I'm, you know, super happy with how the movie came out. Oh, and if you want to buy the movie, you can get it on Amazon or on templegrandin.com.
Oh, great.
Grandin.com, that's my livestock webpage if you want to look up my livestock stuff.
Temple, let's take a quick break so that Jack can catch up. And please stay on the line. We'll come right back because I want to talk to you for a couple minutes about gypsum.
Okay.
This is The Main Course on Heritage Radio Network. Our guest on the line is Dr. Temple Grandin, the eminent professor of animal sciences and many times over and well-known author. Temple, thanks again for joining us. One of the things that came up recently in the news on the Huffington Post, and I know that this has been on the back burners of the livestock industry for the last 2 or 3 years, but it's now making its way into the mainstream, and that is the GPSA rules, which were up for debate in Congress right now. GPSA is known for the Grain Inspection, Packers, and Stockyards Administration, which oversees the enforcement of livestock business, basically. Can you tell us what these new rules mean in terms of creating a fairer marketplace for farmers?
I'm very concerned that if some of these rules aren't changed, they could really wreck some of the kind of alliances of between producers and markets that the local programs and the organic programs want to have. Because the cattle that are treated right, both in the local markets or Whole Foods or, you know, the Fairway or something like that, and in Cargill or some of the big companies, are the ones where a rancher raises them. Then he does things right, like he vaccinates them 45 days before he weans them, and he preconditions them. And the people that are not in alliances, they don't get paid a premium, so they just throw the calves on a truck screaming and bawling, wean them on the truck, and then they get sick at the feed yard or they get sick at the next place they go to. And systems where producers form alliances, even, you know, alliances with chefs, alliances, you know, through certain plants, these are some of the best things that could happen to the industry. And if those GPSA rules are not handled right, they could actually wreck a lot of the alliances that that people in the let's say the small agriculture and the buy local organic sector are going to want to have.
Well, I noticed, I mean, a couple of years ago we had Bill Bullard on from RCAF, which is a ranchers association. And, of course, he's been very much in the vanguard of fighting against some of the rule changes that he feels would consolidate the industry further. So I think it's a really complex bunch of issues.
The problem is you've got people writing these rules that don't know anything about the cattle mm-hmm. market. And we've got to make sure we don't end up writing rules that would wreck something really good, you know, like Nyman Ranch, for example.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, those pigs are raised to a certain spec. They have a program where they inspect the farms to make sure they're following the, you know, the farming practices and things they want. That's what's called an alliance. And you've got to make sure that they write these rules in such a way that it's not going to hurt doing these alliances.
But it sounds like the bigger packers, like even Cargill or Smithfield or JBS, are looking to break down some of those or further consolidate the industry so that they own more of the ranchers and they can kind of do business the way they want to.
Well,
am I misinterpreting
let's
that?
Let's look at a parallel industry. Let's look at the beer industry, because the way it's worked out has been very, very similar. You know, you got the big companies, Budweiser and those people like that. And I remember 20 years ago or so, they wanted to try to get into the microbreweries. Mm-hmm. Well, it did not work. Basically, you got two different parts of the industry. You're going to have the big boys, and then you're going to have the smaller ag. And they are legitimate parts of the market, just like having breweries. We've got very successful Fat Tire Brewery here in Fort Collins, and it sells its beer. And the Budweiser plant that's also here in Fort Collins sells their stuff. And there's going to be a place for all these niche markets, and the big boys are too big and clumsy to go into the niche markets. They tried, but it didn't work. And I think it's a place for both in the marketplace. I think both sides need to stop chucking rocks at each other and sell your own product. But we want to make sure that we don't have stupid rules made that would make it impossible to have something like Nyman Ranch or to have a product like Ranchers Reserve, which is Cargill's mm-hmm. you know, alliance type of product. Sell your own stuff. Fat Tire's been surviving just fine, and Budweiser's doing just fine right here in Fort Collins, and it's the same kind of a deal as between big ag and little ag.
But there's also, you know, on another vision, you know, kind of example is like what happens with Microsoft, where they have a monopoly and they really fight to push other smaller companies from even existing. So, I mean, is there a bad guy to independent alliances out there? I mean, is there someone like fighting a little bit against almost like, you know, like
you
the mafia?
You want to make sure the rules will allow the alliances.
Well,
that's the important thing.
What would be the rule change that would be most worst
and
for
again,
these guys?
I wish you'd ask me stuff about cattle behavior and physiology and things like that. I'll be perfectly honest, I haven't read the TIPSA rules for about a year because it kind of got laid aside.
That's okay. We can move on. Not to worry. So why don't we talk a little bit about what you're working on now in terms of, do you have any books in the works? Are you traveling a lot?
I've been doing lots and lots of traveling. I just, I've just been doing talks at universities to get students interested in animal behavior. Mm-hmm. We need to get students interested in stuff like animal behavior. I do a lot of talks with veterinary students. I just talk to them about things like you got to be observant.
Right.
You know, things as simple as don't put the dog on a slippery table so it's sliding all around and freaking out. You know, put it on a mat.
My fiance is reading
that
book.
That simple, and boy, they're writing that right down because nobody's observed. What's your animal look like? If you're working with a horse, is his eyes popping out and they're white? Then your horse is getting all upset. I want students to observe those things. I also want to get people interested in you know, doing things with animals. I've given some talks at some dog training seminars and horse seminars, and I'd like to see a lot more young people getting involved in doing things with animals.
Well, my fiance, Anne, is reading your book. I think it's called Dogs Make Us Human.
Animals make us human.
It's Animals Make Us Human.
But there's a dog on the cover in this one.
Yeah, that's right.
So let me ask you, you said some things are visible. But then there are other things that are not, because she was telling me, for instance, that certain breeds of dogs have been, things have been bred out of them, like a submissive gene.
That's correct, yes. And it varies with the breeds. And basically, in domesticating animals, you neotenize the animal so it maintains, you know, puppy-like characters. You also tend to extend the critical period for socialization, like the wolf, for example, has a short period of socialization. And there's some dogs that don't know how to submit.
Like the poodle, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and then if it doesn't submit, then they fight. And the other thing you can really get into problems is animals that have been raised alone. Dogs, puppies that are just raised alone, they're not socialized with other dogs, they're not socialized with toddlers. That can be a huge problem, because in the mind of the dog, a toddler and a big person are two totally different things. Mm-hmm. That little person is a different picture than the big person. So it's very important for puppies to get socialized to toddlers. Otherwise, you could possibly get dangerous prey drive behavior towards toddlers, which could be tragic.
Now, are any of these things preconceived in dog? Is like, does revenge exist as an emotion with dogs?
Well, let's talk about emotions in animals. You know, there's some people don't want to think that animals even have emotions. And what's interesting, and I talk about this in Animals Make Us Human, is there's a lot of research that shows that animals have emotions, but it's all over the neuroscience literature. And what the neuroscience literature has shown is that dogs and other mammals definitely have fear. That's the primal emotional survival. There's rage. There's also what's called separation distress. You know, you leave a dog at home and he's chewing up the ass and maybe licking his paw too much. That's separation anxiety. The neuroscientists call that panic. I don't really like that term because it gets mixed up with fear. So you have separation distress, and then you also have an emotion of seeking. Like some Labrador retrievers, they just want to chase the ball all the time. You take the dog to a new place, it just sniff, sniff, sniff everywhere. That's seeking, that novelty seeking. And then you also have sex, and you've got mother-young nurturing, and you've got play. And those are emotional systems that have been mapped, fully mapped in the brains of mammals.
Would you include humor in play? Do you think dogs are funny?
Well, you see, problems with dogs where people have, you know, are verbal. I think animal emotions are simpler, because when you look at the brain, where the emotional drivers are located, it's the same pretty much in a pig and in a person. I actually had a chance to dissect brains when I was at the University of Illinois, and you cut the human brain right down the middle, and you cut the pig brain right down the middle, where the emotions circuits are located. It's pretty much the same, but what's different, human being has a huge cortex, huge, huge. And so you can take that emotion and filter it through and get it a lot more complicated. Then you have language. Is revenge just kind of a little bit of anger? You know, words give, you know, nuances of meaning.
Right.
I think there's a complexity. Emotions get much more complex in people than in animals. Dogs are also more in the present. You know, he wags his tail 1 minute, maybe the hackles up the next minute, and then he's over it. It's a lot more in the present.
I know people like that.
Temple, you would be very proud of me. I have two Scottish Terriers that I take to my work every single day, and they come around with me. I can walk them off leash. In the streets, not in very busy streets, but on my little street. So you would be, one day I hope you get to meet my Scotties. I think,
I think it's great that you can bring them to work, because then they're not going to be getting all upset being home alone. And,
right.
And one thing that has been learned looking at some of these circuits and some of the genetics is that how fearful an animal is and its tendency to get separation distress. In other words, its ability to tolerate being home alone does vary with genetics. They're separate traits.
Well, you didn't mention jealousy, did you? Because there is jealousy or anger when I got one dog later to keep the other one company, and it was like 21 human years of him not forgiving me for doing that. You know, he was so upset that I got another dog. I mean, there is jealousy, right? Or when a kid comes into the picture and they used to be the only thing.
Well, they get into the whole, you know, subordinate thing, and you know, then they, you know, new dog comes in, they got to determine who's going to be boss.
That's right.
That's something they determine. And if you have an animal that's been reared totally alone, they don't kind of know the give and take of social rules. And you know, and when one becomes boss, you don't keep fighting. You just, okay, I'll roll over and I'll be subordinate.
And show my tummy.
And there are some breeds that don't have that rollover response.
Yeah, just like kids. I mean, kids can be the same way. Temple, we have to unfortunately wrap it up with you today, but I want to thank you again very much for being on the
yes.
show, and I hope you'll be back
well,
again
I'm sorry
and again.
I couldn't answer all your gypsy questions.
Oh,
I
that's
no
okay.
You asked me about that.
I know what? More. I'll now next time I'll direct the questions better for you. But I do hope that you'll that people will go take a look at your website because I know all your upcoming events are there. So if
well,
anybody's
all I can
interested,
say is they got to make sure they write regulations that don't have unintended bad consequences on the ground.
Absolutely.
And I do know when I looked at that about a year ago that there was some language in there that could actually hurt the types of alliances and things that you're interested in.
That's right. Well, so Temple, we'll be in touch again soon, and thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your day, and
we'll be
right back in just a few minutes with Damian Sansonetti from DBGBs.
Come back soon.
From Barbaloo.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Thank you, Temple.
It's gonna be just what we want. So don't expect it to be more than that. It's just all a competition in the end. So accept the fact. Go grab your life and live it.
We are back at Main Course. It's Sunday. I'm Patrick Martins. I'm with Katie Kiefer. And our next guest is Damian Sansonetti. 5 years after accepting a position at DB Bistro, Damian Sansonetti is now the executive chef at Barbaloo. This is Damian now. I never planned for this to happen, Damian claims with a smile. The less I planned, the more things fell exactly into place. Growing up outside Pittsburgh, Damian was surrounded by the fresh local ingredients of nearby markets and his grandmother's gardens. He fondly remembers days spent making pasta with his grandmothers, curing meats with his grandfather, and assisting his father, the chef, in the Sansonetti family kitchen. Damian's first restaurant job landed him at the dishwashing sink until he worked his way up to the stove of the local diner. After completing a year of college, his early food memories and experiences at the diner prompted him to enroll in the Pennsylvania Culinary Institute in Pittsburgh, and the rest is history. So welcome, Damian. Thanks so much for coming back.
It's good to have you.
So, I mean, we just had the amazing Dr. Temple Grandin on, and so it'd be really interesting to see about all of her humane work, how it relates to the gastronomy side of things. So can you talk about humane slaughter as it relates to taste and texture?
Oh, 100%. Well, the first thing is, after learning about kind of what she did for the industry and how it translates into the finished product that we get at the restaurants, I kind of have all of my cooks try to watch the movie, and you know, it involves more than just, you know, food slaughter and everything else, but it's kind of, you know, without her we kind of wouldn't be where we're at right now, especially how she changed everything back in the day. And whenever animals are raised good and they're treated well, you notice the quality in the meat. I mean, for example, like when we were doing charcuterie tests for our charcuterie promo, which we're very widely known now, and I don't think anybody else does anything extensively as what we do under one, you know, place, we found that, you know, certain pork wasn't translating well to the finished product. You know, the fat wouldn't melt proper way, the meat wouldn't cook the proper way. And then, you know, you came to the picture, and then we, you know, we had other things working out. And then,
so what does that mean? Like that the fat doesn't cook a certain way. Like, is it metallic in taste, or is it chewy, or like how would that translate to, for instance, the diner who is like cutting into it?
Well, there's,
eating
there, like, when you're dealing with especially pigs, there's good fat and bad fat. Some fat melts at a different temperature. Some fat will stay solid. Like when you have your pork bellies, you know, you used to have that fat that kind of stays there. And then there's other fat around the animal that will melt away and kind of gets that like gristly kind of fat that you know, can't really chew, but then you get that unctuous fat that's really nice and creamy and velvety. But when you have animals that are raised properly, these good qualities stay intact a lot better.
Mm-hmm. Do you have particular breeds that you look to for specific qualities of fat or lean meat?
Well, for our basic overall charcuterie program and what I use in the restaurant mainly, I mean, you get a lot of mainly Berkshire, but honestly, for myself, I love red wattles. Mm-hmm. I love them. They have a more pronounced porkier flavor. It's that you when you know you can get them, I get them. I want them because they have a little bit darker of a meat color to them, and the flavor of them and the fat in them is really pronounced. It's, I mean, that's for me, it's porky pork, you know. But I think it's, some people kind of may shy away from that too because they're not used to, you know. We're still trying to get people on the whole boat with, you know, buying, you know, local stuff and, you know, sourcing out all the ingredients. And I mean, it's coming more of a standard practice now, but when you start introducing other even more intense flavors of things that are, you know, maybe not there before. I mean, what was it like the pork industry used to be called, like pork the other white meat? I mean, mm-hmm. I don't think they have that slogan anymore.
No, but
I mean,
they recognized it was a disaster.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, people was like, oh, this lean kind of semi, you know, tan white meat. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's like you're breeding out all the things that we love about, you know, the pig.
So, so yeah, and that, is that a discussion you have with all new purveyors? Because I know you source from a lot of lamb guys, goat people. I mean, you probably have more purveyors than most restaurants. I mean, is that something you discuss? How's it slaughtered? Where's it slaughtered? And do you put special emphasis on how the animals are treated at the end?
Yeah, I mean, I like to know how they're treated, where they're coming from, how far away from us they're coming from. I've actually met with some of the farmers that. Some of my purveyors have that they interact with, and it's good to know, one, to see who these guys are. And some of these guys came from other farm systems that back in the day started to put in things that, you know, the temple got involved in, or you know, part of Nyman Ranch was involved in and stuff too. So you know they're coming from, you know, some good sound ground, and they're implementing things. They're taking it more, and it's my thing is I want to be able to buy and have more of these things to showcase the restaurant, because it's so hard, it seems like, to find good local stuff sometimes. And I know, like, we're in New York City, but there's so much, you know, farmland around us, like, you know, just an hour outside the city, there's so much stuff, and want to try and be able to keep finding ways to be able to get farmers to bring in things to us. Mm-hmm. You know, because when we can get great things to sell to people, it makes us look good, you know, but we forget where all the stuff comes from. And that's why I'm trying always, like, you know, show my cooks where everything comes from, just so, you know, Keep the whole cycle going.
Well, it's definitely, I made many deliveries to Barbalud, and it is one of the nicer places to deliver to because everything's so massive. You have your own.
Delivered a lamb in the rain that one day.
Oh, man. Now, talk about the transformation of Lincoln Center with Barbalud, now Balud Sud, and then the Epicerie. I mean, you were there years ago, and now all of a sudden it's turned into a little Danielle
Empire
zone.
It really is.
Yeah, we have like the Danielle corner there right now. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of cool. I mean, when we kind of came into the whole area, I mean, we first took over kind of an old space, and there was a bank next to us that was going to be originally the Barbalud space, but, you know, with, you know, relationships with the bank and the landlord and all that stuff, but we eventually got that over for Balud Sud, which opened up a few months ago. Mm-hmm. And the Epicerie Balud right in the front there as well. So we kind of have a little, we're taking over the like neighborhood again. But it was good when we first got there, because it was kind of like almost like the Upper West Side was starting to get to be like the new Tribeca, you know. Nobody kind of really went up there. It was, you know, kind of a lot of families, or you went out there to shop. I mean, yeah, you had Fairway and Zay Bars, but nobody really talked about the food except for like I have a small handful of guys that were up there.
Well, there were very few good restaurants on the Upper West Side until recently. I think Bill Telepan, when he opened up his restaurant there, was kind of in the vanguard of really high-end restaurants. And Danielle came shortly after that opened, I think, was when he opened Barbalud. So those two guys, I feel like, were sort of the linchpins, and then everybody followed.
Well, then there
followed.
Was that Cheska and
That's
West.
True. That was before, yeah.
And then you would have to go like Carmine's. I mean, but there's Community Food and Juice. No, I mean, Carmine's a lot of people went to. But Community Food and Juice I like. But yeah, no, the Upper West Side was always ironically the like best the place ever was Victor's Cafe on 68th or 69th
in Columbus.
That's
right, and they moved. But really, it was, I mean, even though we had Fairway, Citarella, and Zay Bars, there was a real dearth of good restaurants. It was all kind of mid-level stuff with just a few little stars studded here and there. And now I think it's really growing.
Well, originally it was O'Neill's and remember?
The Ginger Man.
With the roller skates, where all the girls went on the roller skates. no, that was called Saloon, remember?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so yeah, that place has really transformed. So does that affect your menu now? Because with the attention that the Epicerie gets and then the attention now Balud Sud, do you stay true and consistent to what had gotten you there, or are you now trying new things to, I don't know, stay one step ahead or
You're always trying to stay one step ahead and trying to be, we want to be consistent, but we also want to be a little different. Each of our three things there, I mean, we're a very close, tight-knit group, but each one of us does something differently, and each one of us does something differently great. But we also want to stay consistent with what got us there, what got us the recognition, and, you know, why people continually come to our restaurant. I mean, mm-hmm. we're never slow. You know, but we're also great to be there because it's like we're a neighborhood restaurant as well. You know, yeah, we're there when you go to the theater or whatever, but, you know, we get out so many locals that just come in that are in the neighborhood or live in the building, and we've become like, you know, a local neighborhood restaurant as well, which is so cool because you get to see people over and over again. It's like they start to become part of the family a little bit.
So now with all these restaurants around the world that Danielle has, would you say there's more that unites these restaurants or more that's different? You know, because he has high-end ones, now lower-end ones, he has curing ones, he has now fish-centric one. Like, right. Is there common? Are there more common threads or less?
Well, I think...
Or what is consistent between
them? Well, the common vein between all of them, I mean, all of the chefs pretty much have all worked for Danielle for, you know, a certain period of time, and we all kind of understand where he's coming from, and we get him. You know, like, I've been with him for many years, and the chef at Sued, you know, has been with him for a few years, and, you know, my... executive sous chef just left to go and be the executive chef at DBGB. And we worked together, you know, at Barbalud and at Danielle's before. So, you know, everybody kind of understands and gets the whole idea of what Danielle wants to, you know, his vision, you know, and then...
Which is what? Is it a certain level of quality and then you have freedom within it? Or is it X amount of dishes that can never change and then you fill in the rest? Like... What is that je ne sais quoi? I mean, is it just a standard?
Well, there's always a quality standard. I mean, we never try and, you know, we're never going to dip below something. It's always, we keep trying to kind of almost surprise you a little bit. Like, you know, we're a bistro, but we're kind of not really a bistro or a wine bar. You know, we're going to have something different than any other bistro or wine bar will have with our charcuterie selections, with our take on, you know, classic, you know, kind of French cooking, where it's, you know, it may sound like something you may have seen in La Rousse, but, you know, once the plate hits the table and the fork cuts the meat and the flavor in your mouth, you're like, oh, wow, okay. And then the ingredients that we use to make up that dish as well. You know, I mean, we're not going to be, you know, kind of just hanging out and just hoping everything's all cool and everything else. We want to keep moving forward, trying new things out. And then that's, you know, I think we progressed from where we were at almost 4 years ago. And, you know, we keep going forward as a restaurant. I think that's anything of a good, successful restaurant is they don't just stay still. They keep moving forward and trying to keep doing new things, you know,
like
without
goat.
Changing everything, like goat.
So what are you going to do with these two goats you've committed to every week for the month of Goat-tober?
I got a lot of cool stuff planned. I mean, I want to do some pasta. I'm actually going to try and attempt some charcuterie with it.
So what cuts would you use for pasta? Is that the ground and the things left over at the end, or do you use, like, the leg or the shoulder or something like that?
Well, I'm going to use the shoulder and the neck of it because it's going to stew really nice. And it has a good pronounced flavor to it. And then I'm going to try a couple different kind of pasta shapes and see what I want, because I might leave some, you know, like a nice ragu. Then we might have some that's ground, like a bolognese. Then I want to kind of make like a cassoulet with some.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we're going to kind of try, like, you know, cassoulet, you know, it's got pork into it and duck, you know, maybe you find some lamb sneaking in there. But I want to kind of try goat. I mean, it's great, and it's got good, full flavor to it, so... Why not let's try and take that in and have all them beans and everything else suck up all that goodness.
Well, let me ask a question. I thought you were going to say this about goat, but let's just then pretend pig. Let's say you buy a whole pig and then you have the shanks. How many quote unquote specials can you relate to the front? Can you go to the front of the house and say, I have two of this?
Oh, yeah.
First come, first serve. Well, and then two dishes is enough for a special. So you might have 20 specials in the night.
Well, it's exactly kind of almost what I do. Like in the restaurant, it's divided into sections. So, you know, we might have four or five sections in the night. So I'll go, okay, server A, you know, you're going to have, you know, the four shanks. You know, server B, you're going to have the loin, and then we'll do this. Server C, you're going to have the racks. You're going to have the roast leg.
Very interesting.
You're going to have the shoulder. And then occasionally, you know, and I like to get all the off one with it too. So then I'm like, okay, you're going to be in charge of the brain, the kidneys, you know, and whatever else we get, you know, coming in with the guy.
Very interesting. So it does go the route. You regionalize the restaurant. Yeah. I'd always wondered how that worked.
You know, then you can spot it out too, because there are certain sections where sometimes people tend to eat, you know, different things. So, you know, you want to be able to, you know, maybe people in the front might not, you know, they're more kind of be kind of like walk-ins or so. So, you know, they may be more easier to sell a pasta to, you know, right up there. But then too, if somebody's like, oh man, one of my guests saw, you know, that Shanko, they're kind of someone. Yeah, go ahead.
No sure. problem.
Yeah. But when I create a buzz too in the restaurants, when people see things, you know, it's something that maybe might not be able to have on the menu all the time. And that's how I do specials. It's things that like are very precious to us and to be able to get in and to work with.
When you mentioned the fact that you were neighborhood restaurants, I mean, I was thinking just now as you were talking about how you know, can serve a special, like one group in the restaurant will get the shanks and one will get the thing. And if you have somebody who comes back over and over again, then those are the kinds of people that I would imagine you stay in touch with. How much outreach do you do? How much mm-hmm. education do you do with your customers in advance? Like the people who are regulars, do you like let them know that this week we're doing blah, blah, blah? And
some of them, yeah. I have a good, you know, amount of customers that will email me and like, okay, hey, we're coming in for dinner tonight, what do you have? Or we're probably going to come back and, you know, I'll see them, I'll go upstairs when I can get out of the kitchen and go and say hi to them and like, oh, so what are you doing next week? Oh, well, I'm planning on getting this or that. Or, you know, some of them follow me on Twitter and I'll kind of throw out the specials we're doing for that day or what we're planning for the week, and some of them will get back to me or come in the restaurant and, you know, they're interested in some things that were going on. They always want to see what's new and what's different.
Mm-hmm. Very, very interesting. And now, is Thanksgiving every chef's worst nightmare? It's the one day when you get 400 pounds of just the largest North American bird ever, you know, and they just are huge. I always remember going to Bar Balut, and there was, you know, a guy who was working the morning shift, you know, 8 a.m., and he saw me and I think it was Jack actually last year bring down mm-hmm. two huge boxes, and he was like, oh my god, two boxes. I was like, you have another 24 boxes upstairs. I swear that guy almost had a heart attack.
The thing I remember hearing most is the buddy in the kitchen saying, there's more.
I'm like, 24 boxes more, dude. Oh my god. So how, I mean, is it your worst nightmare, and how do you handle such a crazy American tradition in a New York kitchen?
I mean, you just have to have a plan with it. You know, you have to plan about how you're going to execute it, what you want to do. I mean, it's like anything that's well planned out, and if you execute it properly, it's going to go good. But, you know, it's great to be using the heritage turkeys for Thanksgiving. I mean, as we talked about before, I even like told you like certain characteristics from certain turkeys about how the fat reacted mm-hmm. to them, and how like some of the turkeys, their fat was like great for some of the charcuterie and like the Ballantine and stuff, and the way that it kept the Ballantines moist and everything.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that texture, that meat is strong.
Oh yeah.
Do you do something special? I mean, you don't present just a roast turkey with all the American trimmings.
They have the best stuffing in the world.
Really?
Yeah.
Because you put foie gras in it or things. Something? Oysters?
No, I do a couple of different things. And we have done, like, you know, a whole roast of turkey for, you know, private parties. And,
sure.
You know, we've had people take up our private event spaces that we have downstairs. We have three beautiful rooms. And, you know, we'll do, you know, someone wants to come in and not cook at home, and we've done like whole roasted turkeys for people on the table. But, you know, I like to take out, you know, yeah, I mean, it's not the same exact looking whole turkey for the restaurant. So, you know, we bone out the leg, we, you know, stuff it with a little bit of stuffing, smooth the skin out, roll it, tie it back up, and then, you know, slowly cook it, roast it, and it comes out really nice and juicy.
That sounds amazing.
We'll do something a little different. And I love cornbread. You know, I mean, I grew up in Pittsburgh, but like, we're kind of, you know, got a lot of some Southern influence going in there, but I grew up eating some good cornbread, and, you know, I love good cornbread stuffing, and I take all the trimming meat too. So, you know, I make a turkey sausage out of some of the trimmed meat, you know, and all the giblets and all the gizzards and everything. So we'll stuff that back into the leg too and serve that on the side as well. I mean, the staff can't get enough of, like, when we use staff, it's like, you know, we almost have to shut the restaurant down for an hour because everybody gets so, like, you know, tired. Like, oh, okay, yeah.
Tryptophan?
Yeah.
Yeah, they just all fall fast asleep. Oh, brother. Well, no, I mean, it's very interesting. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. Very interesting the way you responded to the question, because I always wondered how a restaurant of your size deals with, like, you know, when you bring in a lamb that's not going to yield you two portions of each cut, you know, is very, very interesting. So anything on the menu you want to talk about before we close out? Anything that people in the next couple of weeks, besides goat, Any menu changes or things you're excited or seasonal foods coming?
Well, I mean, now you got that chill in the air. So, you know, we've been hitting the markets a lot harder. And now with, you know, everybody kind of getting back online after the hurricane and everything, we're just trying our best right now to support our local farmers too, that is even the ones that got really affected really bad with the hurricane and everything. So we have to remember, no matter what happens, you know, with them, they were there before and they're going to be there after. We're going to keep helping them, supporting them and everything. And, you know, with this, the whole Goat-tober thing, we're excited to do that and trying to work more towards, you know, getting everything sourced out great and all of our fish being sustainably harvested and caught, and you know, just having a good old time cooking up in the kitchen.
Do you work with Sea to Table at all? Have you ever heard of that group?
Yep, I've worked with them a little bit.
They've been on the show
before.
Yeah,
I've worked with them a little bit, and then I got a couple of guys who I've worked with for years, and they, like, some of them actually know the fishermen that go out on the day boats. Wow. And it's nice to know those guys too, because that's another big industry that's like full of a bunch of, like, you know, misleading things and how they handle the fish and where it comes from and everything. Absolutely. So, you know.
Well, let's take a short break, and then we'll come back and say goodbye to Damien and talk about next week's show.
Okay, sounds great.
Will somebody hear me now? Listen to what I have to say. I speak about a secret crime that happens day to day. He comes upon us from behind, and right before us boldly walks. He searches for the idle minds and whispers evil thoughts. He's not a thing that you can see.
Well, we're back. Next week's show is going to be very exciting. We're going to be talking about the Farm Bill. Is there a vote coming up or something?
Absolutely. The 2012 Farm Bill is going to be coming up in front of Congress very soon. And we're down to kind of the wire in terms of determining where allocations are going to be, what subsidies are going to be continued, whether or not the ethanol program will remain as a subsidized program, and so forth. So
now, haven't all these things been decided? Is all this nonprofit lobbying really going to go anywhere in the minds of these Congress and all that?
Well, I guess we'll find out. But I mean, it's I think it's becoming more and more obvious that the impact of monoculturism with corn and soybeans, although some farmers are making a lot of money, it's having a lot of impact on the environment and also on food prices overall, because corn being divided into food versus fuel has become a very expensive proposition and has had a huge impact on the livestock industry. So there are reasons why Congress could legitimately consider ending the subsidies to corn farmers to help out the livestock part of the agricultural industry. So so Ferngale Estro, who has been a guest on the show before, and is a superbly articulate spokesman for explaining out these issues, which are very complex.
Is she in studio?
She's going to come in studio, as far as I know. Yep. Uh-huh. And she might be coming with another guest. I'm not sure yet. And then after that, we'll have whoever.
A chef. I kind of like this new two-tiered show. We've gone down to an hour, and now we have, you know, basic trajectory is a policy first half and a chef second half. And I like that because it goes from, you know, ideas to concrete gastronomy.
It's practical. Yeah, exactly.
You've come a long way since the Q report, guys.
Yeah. Thanks, Jack. Well, I want to say thank you very much to our two guests, Dr. Temple Grandin and Damien Sansonetti, in studio today.
Barbalut is a great restaurant.
It's an awesome restaurant.
Go there. You can spend a little money or you can spend a lot. It depends what you want. But it's really a restaurant for everybody.
And if you don't want to sit down at a restaurant, check out the Épicerie, because the charcuterie and the cheeses, which are selected by Anne Saxelby, are superb. And just if you want just a quick little snack, a coffee and something as you're shopping around on the Upper West Side, it's really a terrific place to go. Not to give them free advertising, but it is really a nice place.
No, it's very lovely. You can't deny it.
I mean, the food is awesome.
The Heritage Meat Shop.
The Heritage Meat Shop.
That is also a place. Now, it's over 14 miles away from Barbalut, so
that's
Danielle
right.
cannot get upset.
Absolutely
if I
no competition.
And it's where Ann Saxelby has her. As their place. So hopefully one day we will have a Barbalut item there, but we certainly have great charcuterie, and Dan Honig did a great job. So if you're listening, come down, visit us. 120 Essex Street. Essex Street Market is unbelievable. They have great artisan cheeses from America, chocolates,
great
fruits,
bread.
Vegetables, fish.
Yeah.
So anyway, we've been produced by Jack Inslee. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, I'll see you next week.
See you next
Thanks,
week.
Thanks, Damien.
Thank you.
This is a message from Fork and Anchor. Aaron Fitzpatrick, the host of our wine program, Unfiltered, is looking for help on Kickstarter to open Fork and Anchor, a general store inspired by two food-loving ladies with an equal affection for urban life, the sea, and the agricultural paradise of Long Island's North Fork. The store is situated in a growing community of farmers and winemakers and will become a meeting place offering prepared foods, a variety of sun-dries, and a selection of homespun products, many of which will have their origins in New York State. Your backing will help them fulfill their dream of fostering relationships with the community and making the local food system accessible on a broader scale. Search Kickstarter.com for Fork and Anchor and donate today.